Welcome to Grumpy Strategist, episode 52. I'm Michael Shoebridge, your host, and I'm here with SIA's head of research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello,
Marcus,
Michael.
How's the fresh air?
The fresh air is good. For our listeners' benefit, we've had to abandon the bunker. Last week, you started your own continuous naval shipbuilding enterprise, building a kayak, which you've started to fiberglass. Unfortunately, the fumes overwhelmed the ventilation system, so we've abandoned the bunker until the fumes clear.
I'm thinking it was a mistake to build a fiberglass and wood kayak in an underground bunker. And there's the other issue of, how am I going to get the bloody thing out? Because it won't fit through some of the hatches and sort of protection systems that we have at the bunker.
Well, you should have built it in modules. Modules are the way to go, Michael. Everybody builds in modules now. I know you're a traditionalist in your approach to shipbuilding. Yes, unfortunately, you do have that problem now of how are you going to get the kayak out of the bunker.
I'm like that Italian shipbuilder that built a ship in its yard and then realized it couldn't get it to the ocean because it wouldn't go under the bridge. Yeah.
I don't know. There's precedent and you haven't learned.
I have. This is continuous shipbuilding. I'm building one kayak extremely slowly to provide steady state employment for the workers. And it's unarmed at this point. So it's even more
I think we will have to work on that. I mean, at the moment, there hasn't been much requirements creep, but if you're going to do a proper defence project, you've got to have a lot of requirements creep. I think at least 16 vertical launch cells. I mean, the industry standard's 32 now, so you need at least 16.
I've got a few top weight issues. I'm fitting a small top hat version of the CEA radar, and that's causing a few structural issues.
Yeah, so some power, weight, and cooling issues there.
Anyway, it's good to be out of the bunker, and if you hear birds, that's because the bird life here in the Brindabellas is quite prolific. We'll do the Trump tour, the Trump Xi meeting. We'll
the 12 out of 10 meeting.
You can't get better than, well, you probably can. His next meeting will be better,
13,
no doubt.
That's better.
We've got the great news about nuclear submarines. If we thought they were good before, everybody wants them, so they must be.
Submarines for everybody.
A little bit on Golden Dome. I think you've dug out a study from the pretty Republican-aligned Heritage Foundation, which gives a bill, which is an interesting bill. And then a bit about Indo-Pak, that wonderful arms exposition that was protested at, and some of the stuff that people set up there.
I was inside. I wasn't one of the protesters.
Right. Oh, you got inside.
I was outraged at some things, but I didn't protest about it.
Okay, well, just quickly on that, I was really cheered up by Pat Conroy, the Minister for Defence Industries, strong statement of principle that Australia won't sell weapons to the Israeli military, and any Australian-made parts for the F-35s that they get aren't sold to them by us, they're sold to them by that nasty third party, the American Lockheed Martin Corporation. So it's very strong. No weapon sales to Israel. Equally strong, though, on buying whatever weapons the ADF want from Israeli defense companies. So you can't get stronger principles than what we have.
We'll stand by our principles until we have to sacrifice them because you've got something we really want.
Yeah, okay. And he managed to say both those things one after the other and not go cross-eyed or have blood come out of his ears. So I was very impressed with his stoicism.
And I do have to say, if I was an Israeli defense company, after the whole Elbit battle management debacle, so the Land 200 debacle, where essentially with no justification whatsoever, after literally billions spent on this land battle management system being delivered by Elbit, an Israeli company, the army turned around and said, no, we don't want it anymore, thanks, go away.
Yeah, because
and we'll give you a whole bunch, huge hundreds of millions of dollars in compensation, but we can't really say why we don't want it.
Yeah.
We'll make some sort of hints out there that it's somehow related to security, but we won't actually back that up. We just want you to go away, piss off. You know, so if I was the Israelis, I'd sort of look at that and go, do I really want to work with you guys?
Well, and also, you won't sell me anything except when you money launder it through a third party and pretend you haven't, but you want to buy my stuff. So, you know, what kind of relationship is Mr. Conroy actually promoting? Now, relationships.
Yes.
What a great meeting between two presidents. Well, one general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and one American president. The Xi Jinping-Donald Trump meeting happened at the South Korean military base, which was the last foothold that the Americans and the South Koreans had when the North Koreans and the Chinese were trying to push them off the peninsula before the famous Inch on landings and that the reconquering of South Korea.
You're a student of history, Michael.
Well, I like to think so, yeah. Mm. They met on historic ground at that military mm-hmm. base, and the markets are so relaxed now. Everything is clear. What is clear, Marcus?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. We seem to have just gone back to where we were a few months ago, before the latest round of Trump punitive tariffs and the Chinese response to the punitive tariffs. So,
and you called me a student of history. You've just gone back 6 months. That's incredible.
So, first of all, despite U.S. legislation saying the U.S. has to... Michael, why are you pointing at me, Michael?
You want me to speak into the microphone?
So, yeah, even though the U.S. Congress has passed legislation saying that a law saying that the Chinese have to divest TikTok and a U.S. entity has to take it. Donald Trump hasn't really done that. So she walked away, still owning TikTok. I mean, I guess the one-year ban that she had imposed on exports of critical minerals and rare earths to the U.S. has been removed, or let's just say put on a temporary hold.
It's a pause, isn't it? So is the extra tariff that Trump said he was putting on Chinese goods. I mean, you're right. This is not really a deal. This is just the most recent escalation by both sides has been paused.
Has been wound back.
And we're back. I don't know how many times we're going to hear the Chinese government's going to crack down on fentanyl exports to America, and how many times we're going to hear they're going to buy a universe full of American soybeans. How many times can you sell the same pig?
Well, I guess the one good thing is for the people who are worried that somehow Trump and Xi would come to this grand bargain, you know, and divide the Indo-Pacific between them.
I was a bit worried about that, but it still is a lurking
worry. All right, hey, I'm a student of history. So we have a precedent. The Treaty of Tordesillas, 1494, between Spain and Portugal, where they drew a line down the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and everything on one side of it went to the Spanish, everything on the other side went to the Portuguese.
One question, what's the relevance of the tortoise here?
No, not tortoise, Tordesillas, okay. Right. So for the people who are fearing that something similar could be done between China and the US, that hasn't happened. So, you know, the US has not disengaged. Whether Donald Trump remains committed to maintaining sort of US presence in the Western Pacific is not clear.
You know, however, I love this. This is the world we're in now, where the absence of a disastrous car crash from something that Donald Trump does is celebrated as a huge win. The fact that they didn't sign a document about a tortoise that split up the region between them is great. The fact that he didn't throw Taiwan under the bus is also great. We're celebrating him not doing disastrous things for millions of people. Mm-hmm. We're not actually celebrating anything good. We're celebrating the absence of disaster.
Mm-hmm. Though, just on a slight aside on car crashes or train wrecks, the recent elections in the US. So there were some state governorships or a few sort of local elections around the place were a total train wreck for the Republicans and Donald Trump. So I think we're sort of in the middle of a race at the moment between the Democrats managing to actually compete and win in elections to regain the power before Donald Trump and the Republicans set things up that there will never be free and fair elections.
A whole lot of redistricting and other things. Mind you, the Democrats in California are busily adding seats that will be Democrat-controlled to the House to rebalance what the Republicans are up to in places like Texas. So there's a race to gerrymander. Yeah.
So, I don't think there's anything terribly new out of the 12 out of 10 Trump-Xi meeting. Trump also met with the Koreans.
Right. You're right. I think there's still the structural problem. I think Trump wants a big deal with Xi, but Xi doesn't want a big deal with Trump. Xi is in trouble economically, and that is causing some political pressure. But he seems to assess that just playing the long game with Trump and not giving away anything. And if Trump wants to raise the stakes, you know, raise him, meet him and raise him again. And that just worked. So the prospects of a grand deal mean you've got to have two parties and only one party wants to make a deal.
She is winning at the moment. Mm. She is winning in this race for who is going to be the most powerful state in the world. She is winning. Like the US is consciously shooting itself in the foot in giving up its global leadership in science and technology. I mean, the Trump administration has declared war on the institutions and entities that have created
that have
American leadership.
Wealth and technology.
You know, and the number one rule is, you know, if you see your adversary making a mistake, don't interrupt him.
And I think that's what she is doing. He's protecting Chinese equities by doing those escalations when Trump does something. And then he can remove the escalation but not resolve the structural problem because he thinks time's on his side.
So bottom line, no fundamental change to the structural issues there. Okay, South Korea. Trump had another meeting with South Korea. Apparently, when he rocked up to South Korea, he got some nice presents.
That's good.
So South Korean President Lee presented to Donald Trump a gold medal, which, according to his media report,
won so much.
Represents the Grand Order of Mugungwa, the country's highest honor, and Trump is the first president to receive it.
Really? The first, you say? Wow. Yeah. Wow, that's very special. Special person.
I mean, you sort of go, US president should have been extorting the South Koreans well before this, because Donald Trump extorted $350 billion out of them, and he gets a gold medal. But Trump said, it's as beautiful as it can possibly be. I'd like to wear it right now.
Yes.
That's not all. There was more. Next was a replica of a royal crown from the Silla Kingdom, which existed from 54 BC to 935 AD.
Okay, I am.
You sort of go, did he want to wear that? I'm surprised he didn't wear that.
Yeah, I want to put it on right now.
Maybe the No King's Day demonstrations were a little too close.
I don't think J.D. Vance was along with him, but if he had been, I'm pretty sure we would have had a Zelensky moment where Vance would have said what was on everybody's minds. I'm sure it was on your mind as you read about this. A replica? What kind of disrespectful thing is that to give to Donald Trump? Where's the real one?
Have you ever said thank you for what we did in the 1950s?
They are so ungrateful. Some replica. So he's lucky J.D. Vance wasn't along. And they sealed the $350 billion investment deal, but the South Koreans made the point that they couldn't hand over the entire bag of cash in one go because they haven't got the same arrangements we have for the AUKUS submarine. So they could only pay $20 billion a year because otherwise it would disturb the exchange rate between America and South Korea.
Well, the currency outflows might create mayhem in currency markets. It's yet another example of, I think, countries around the world have sort of worked out how to deal with Donald Trump. You do these deals, you know, Trump gets the huge announceable. When you really unpack it, it may be better than business as usual in favor of the US, but, you know, South Korean direct investment into America, it's going to happen anyway. You know, South Korean purchases of American energy, it's going to happen anyway. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep. But it's celebrating.
But the big new thing, of course, is
nuclear submarines. SSNs for everyone. This is so fantastic. I remember the specialness of the AUKUS deal. You know, this only such a trusted partner as Australia.
Yeah.
You know, we've been in every conflict for over a century with the Americans.
100
years of mateship. Blood. And, you know, that sort of mateship we've built. And also the fact that the AUKUS deal was going to set a new high standard for non-proliferation. There was such a high bar, we heard from our government and Defense Department. No other country could meet such a high bar. So it wouldn't result in proliferation of these kinds of weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Except it seems that that's not true because I think South Korea originally only wanted to buy some fuel from the Americans.
So there was this announcement, you know, and of course it came in the form of, you know, a Trump tweet or, you know, social media thing. And, of course, everybody is then going, what is going on? And, of course, many commentators wrote much before we actually knew anything at all. We've sort of learned a few more things since then with senior South Korean defense officials speaking to the South Korean parliament. So we actually have some real information.
South Korean government officials from defense, when they speak to their information.
I know where you're going with this.
See, that's another reason they shouldn't have them, because our officials say nothing to anybody, including elected representatives.
So there were a lot of speculation about what was going on, because Trump had said these submarines, he has allowed, he's allowed the South Koreans to have nuclear submarines, and even better, they're going to be built in Philly.
Yeah.
Presumably at Hanwha Shipyard.
They were being built of Philly, and I was imagining a nuclear-powered cheese.
Yeah, I don't think so. Might want to get your hearing checked.
Yeah.
So, of course, there was a lot of speculation. It's like, well, if they're being built in America, are they Virginia-class submarines? And, you know, how's that going to impact the AUKUS program? Will that, you know, be...
Yeah, the supply chain.
Drawing on resources we want.
Yep.
Well, it sort of turns out, and I think this was probably pretty guessable at the outset, is that the South Koreans don't really want much from the Americans. Unlike us,
who
could not design and build a reactor or a SSN for it to go on, who essentially need everything, the South Koreans seem to be going, well, we've got a submarine design. We've been working on our small modular reactors.
Yeah.
You know, so we can put it all together. We are actually going to use 20% enriched fuel, which is low enriched uranium, not high in enriched uranium.
French.
So what they're building is basically a 5,000-ton low-enriched uranium-fueled submarine, i.e. what we could have gotten if we'd stuck with the French.
Yes.
So it's looking a lot like the Suffren, the French submarine. Yeah. And so you're going,
who's Suffren now?
They don't actually need that much from the Americans.
Of course they don't, do they? Because they've been pursuing all of the relevant technology in parallel, and they're a highly capable manufacturing and technological nation. I don't get why the South Koreans would sign up to building their nuclear submarines in Philadelphia, because all that is some kind of job for Americans thing, where they end up having America...
Or jobs for South Korean workers in Philadelphia.
But America then has a stranglehold over their use of the weapon. There's no benefit to them. So apart from buttering up Trump, and for Trump, it just underlines again, he doesn't have a strategic bone in his body. This is all, here's another great opportunity to extort money coming into America. I'll have stuff made in America, even if it's for the South Koreans by the South Koreans.
Well, what I would say is we do not know for sure whether they will be built in Philadelphia.
No.
I mean, what comes out of Trump's mouth or what comes out of his social media may not exactly be the truth. And so it may be that components or modules will be built in Philly. Who knows? But another thing to note is that when the South Koreans build ships, they use multiple shipyards.
Mm.
So one company might design it and build the first one, and then another company will build the second one, like the US does with its submarines, and what the Japanese does with its naval shipbuilding. Potentially, the first one could be built in Philadelphia and later ones built by another company in South Korea.
What I'm hoping is Hanwha Ocean, which I think is the company that bought the shipyard in Philadelphia, is going to produce nuclear-powered cruise ships for Americans to sail around on extended cruises where they don't have to come back to port for years.
Mm.
So you could extend your Caribbean cruise.
Oh, now I know what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
Yeah. So I'd hope for a highly enriched uranium reactor powering those cruise ships, because I think just the power you get out of that would run the spas you need. But maybe low enriched will do the job.
But I was taking a look at Google Maps at that shipyard, and I can tell you now, it's looking pretty full. There is not a lot of greenfields, space there. So if you are going to put a shipyard for nuclear-powered submarines there, it's not going to... There's not a nice spot for it already.
So South Korea says they're going to get nuclear submarines. That led pretty quickly to one of their neighbours saying, well, they probably will get nuclear submarines too. You talked in the last podcast about the risk of nuclear proliferation in a weapon sense with South Korea and Japan getting those, but it looks like the first nuclear thing they're going to do in the defense field is submarines.
Well, I have to say that this is probably the least surprising strategic development of the last quarter century, where South Korea one week says they're going to get nuclear-powered submarines, and surprise, surprise, a week later, Japan goes, we're going to do it too. I mean, the FOMO is palpable. I mean, I do have to say, the Japanese do seem to have a better kind of use for nuclear-powered submarines. The South Korean one seems to be, well, the North Koreans have hinted at getting nuclear-powered submarines, so if they're doing it, we need it too.
They sort of floated in the deep water out from the coast for reasons unspecified. Why you need the range and endurance is beyond me, but yeah, there was a great analysis, I thought, that was circulated with a South Korean strategic analyst. Just saying some things that I thought an Australian audience could learn from. We'll put a link in the
Yeah, well, I saw the headline where a military expert calls the pursuit of nuclear submarines, quote, the vanity of a nation drunk on the delusion of becoming a world power. And I was like, oh, I haven't seen that criticism of AUKUS before. But actually, it was a South Korean analyst talking about South Korea's program. But yeah, making the point of like, what exactly do these things do for you?
Well, it talked about the enormous budget opportunity cost, talking about the revolution in warfare and small, smart, many, as opposed to extremely expensive, very few things. They're really, if you just did a replace South Korea with Australia, I thought it was something a lot of people in the Australian national security community should read.
So he said a single nuclear-powered submarine would cost around 2 trillion won just to build, as well as 2.3 billion won in daily operating costs. Now, 2.3 billion won in daily operating costs is about 2.5 million Australian dollars, you know, and that's quite a lot. If we're going to have 8 of them,
well,
we're
South
looking
Korea's
at $20 million a day.
The South Korean one will be about half the size of Snorkel's,
so,
too.
Yeah, ours will be twice the size. Yeah, really interesting piece. Yeah, it is. He's talking about South Korea, not Australia. I like the phrase, the vanity of a nation drunk on the delusion of becoming a world power. I think there is a lot of vanity, drunkenness and delusion in our SSN dreams. Whether we want to become a world power, I'm not quite sure.
I just have been marvelling in the recent weeks about the self-assessment leading to self-congratulation from government ministers and also senior officials, including the soon-to-retire head of the Australian Submarine Agency, where they just keep saying, well, the whole thing is really super and it's all on track, it's all going incredibly well, and because it's going incredibly well, I'm doing a great job. There's no external measure that we can look at beyond these very mundane things, like some Australians are in US courses and we've announced distant investments on things like Henderson. So getting these assertions that everything is going very well, I don't find reassuring at all.
No, I mean, but that's the fundamental problem with our system in that, you know, defence gets to mark its own homework.
Yeah, but it gets reported as if it's all true.
Why would it be any different with the submarine program?
Yeah, but they say it and then it gets reported as this is true because an official said it. Well, they would say it, wouldn't they?
Well, you would say that, Michael.
But one other costing thing, so that's great to have a figure from the South Korean analyst about the cost of nuclear submarines, even small ones. But Golden Dome, the giant US continental missile defense system, space-based, ground-based lasers, we heard $150 billion US dollars.
Well, that was Donald Trump's number.
Has it come in cheaper?
No, so Donald Trump said about $175 billion for this sort of system that would protect the continental US against every conceivable threat.
The threat from within, not the threat from within.
I don't know, maybe it can take out, you know, what are they, Antifa.
Antifa people, Antifa maybe people someone on a speedboat zooming up the Potomac is a drug smuggler.
With a laser, take out those.
A rod from God.
Those radical leftists.
Rod from God, boron rod flung out of space.
So anyway, just an interesting report. This is from War on the Rocks by a US analyst called Todd Harrison, who works for, I think, the Heritage Institute, which is not an Antifa-affiliated institution.
Heritage is a communist entity that came up with that project 2024. Trump denied he had anything to do.
They are not Trump-unfriendly, shall we put it. And Mr. Harrison has come up with a bunch of different, quote, architectures. to achieve Golden Dome and sort of put prices against them, a sort of a range of capabilities, a sort of a spectrum of existing technologies through to new technologies.
Does it depend how much gold is involved? Because I'm thinking Mar-a-Lago, I'm thinking the ballroom. You know, how much gilt and gold you put on this affects the price?
A lot of things affect the price. If you kind of want to do something that does what the president seems to want, you're looking at about $2.4 trillion. Over 20 years.
Two and a half Musks.
That's two and a half Musks. But, you know, so Mr. Harrison gives a range. Obviously, you use existing land-based systems, it's more affordable, but you're not going to have the same coverage. But, yeah, if you want to sort of do what Mr. Trump thinks it should do, the issue is you need space-based low Earth orbit constellations.
Yeah.
So, a kind of Muskian, Starlink kind of system that requires thousands and thousands of
You're going to need windscreen wipers as well, because there's so much other stuff up there and so many commercial satellites. You're going to need something that just sort of brooms them out of the way so you get a clear shot.
Could be running out of room. So that's kind of interesting.
I hope we join
for a couple of reasons. First one is this issue of what's the US's priorities in terms of defense. And a lot of people keep saying, well, you know, they're not going to withdraw from the Indo-Pacific. They can walk and talk and chew gum at the same time. They can shoot Venezuelan drug smugglers. They can do Golden Dome and defend the homeland. And they can still be engaged in the Western Pacific. But if you're spending $2.4 trillion on homeland defense, it will affect
over
your
20 years,
investment priorities.
Yeah, that's right. That is a massive, that's an Orcusian opportunity cost for the Americans. Mm. Yeah.
The second factor why I think it's interesting is that recently a gentleman called Peter Dean, who is an Australian academic.
Is he one of the two supporting researchers for the Defence Strategic Review that led to generational historic changes in defence?
Correct. He worked on the team that wrote the Defence Strategic Review, supporting Angus Houston and Stephen Smith. This would be the Angus Houston who was just quoted in the media as having spoken to the defence chiefs, who told him that their sustainment budgets were being put under pressure because AUKUS was eating everything. Mr. Dean, or Professor Dean,
yes,
we'll give him his title, so said in this report, in the DSR, we said you should acquire air and missile defense and you should do it quickly because it is an extremely high priority. Then, when the government released the new integrated investment program as part of the 2024 National Defense Strategy, a historical document, we all looked at that and went, where did air and missile defense go? It has evaporated completely. Professor Dean has now put out a report saying that exact same thing, saying, you guys aren't doing what we said you should do when we wrote the Defense Strategic Review, and has proposed some ways to get air and missile defense.
I can't help but think of The Princess Bride and the man in black when he's defeated Inigo Montoya on the cliffs.
And get used to disappointment?
Yes, yes. He said, I must know your name. And yeah, the man in black says, get used to disappointment, and knocks him out. Peter Dean obviously doesn't know the defense organization as well as he might, because there's no way that they slavishly follow something done for a government that gets endorsed and accepted, and also something that's going to cost the government billions of dollars. So there's two reasons it didn't happen. One, the government, and two, defense is its budget is full. So I'm sort of saddened to see Peter have his illusions ripped from him.
Well, it happens to all of us sooner or later working with defense. But so just one last thing. I was up at the Indo-Pacific Convention this year. This year's Indo-Pacific Convention up in the Darling Harbour. I had my C2 Robotics hat on there.
So, is that a long black hat?
No, it was a baseball cap, actually. Oh. And Michael, I just wanted to thank all the people who came up to me at the convention, and there were a number of them. You know, I know you're sort of a bit skeptical there, but no, there were quite a few people came up and commented on the podcast and said they really enjoyed listening to the podcast. So thank you to everybody who...
They weren't all relatives?
It wasn't just my mother.
Right.
Let me tell you.
Right.
So thank you to everybody out there who is listening and all the people who are giving us feedback.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And yeah, it's always nice to hear that people are listening. So thanks, everybody.
Anyway, so, I was doing my thing at the stand there, but so I didn't get around much. But I will just say, I think the general vibe, you know, unless you're in one of the big primes stands, so when you come into the convention center, it's sort of like very hierarchical. So there's these huge palatial stands at the front where all the primes are, and as you get further and further towards
you get into
the cheap seats. So as you walk in, surprise, surprise, there you have BAE's stand, which literally is as big as a football field. So to the Australian taxpayer, if you're wondering where your defence dollar is going, it's going so BAE can hire huge stands in the Sydney Convention
Massive
Centre.
Massive audio-visual screens, yep. I hope. Yeah, yep. All brought to you by the Australian taxpayer.
And lots of free beers at 4 o'clock.
Brought to you by the Australian taxpayer.
Free beers, I'm not sure. But that is, for people who haven't been to these conventions, that is a standard part of these things. At 4 o'clock, free beers. So that's somewhere else where your tax dollars are going.
So even if you don't like Weapons of Death, if you like free beer, wait till about 4 o'clock.
Yes, but I would say that the general vibe, certainly amongst the smaller players, was very similar to last year, and that is despite all the talk of historic increases to the defence budget, it is not filtering down to the SMEs. The SMEs are still kind of struggling. And there is sort of no improvement in sight. And you go, well, why is that happening? Well, for that reason we've talked about many times before. If you are trying to do things like SSNs while maintaining a kind of
conventional military
spectrum, conventional top high-end military, you just can't do it on 2% of GDP.
No, well, it turns out you can't run the current force or invest in medium and small enterprise capabilities if you're spending 2% and trying to get nuclear submarines and Hunter frigates. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm glad that there was free beer, but the actual overall picture is quite concerning.
It's very
anyway,
concerning.
Anyway, it was wonderful that Trump didn't throw a bunch of allies and partners actively under a set of buses in the region, but I'm not sure that that gives us the stability and direction that it'd be good for Australia to have with our big partner.
And I guess that's the kind of the point we keep trying to make around 2% of GDP, is that we are not in a stable strategic environment. And as we've seen in history, you being a student of history, that when the great power order starts to change or collapse, you have unpredictable second and third order effects. Ooh. So it may not be war between the US and China. There could be all kinds of other contingencies out there, are very hard to predict. And so if you're spending an amount of GDP, which was appropriate for an era of stability, where you had one state allied to you that was, you know, militarily and economically dominant, that level of spending is not appropriate to as a risk insurance policy for an era of strategic instability.
Well, I think you're right, and I think that's partly what Peter Dean was getting at in his plaintiff article. Anyway, I think I can see that the alarms have turned off on the bunker now, so the fumes will have dissipated. We can get back in. I might get your advice on how many chunks I've got to cut the kayak into to get it out.
Well, I was going to work on installing the towed array today.
Well, let's get it out first, because I don't want that getting tangled. Thanks, Marcus.
Bye, Michael.